Work and Its Own by Emerson Green. The events, characters, and firms depicted in the story are fictitious. Any similarity to actual persons living or dead, or to actual firms, is purely coincidental. 1. I first met Henry 4 years ago, a few months after I graduated high school. 5 cities ago, 9 jobs ago, 4 cars ago, maybe 2,000 joints ago. He was a family friend, sort of. He was mostly my friend. Henry's voice was softer than his appearance would have you think, with his rough white beard, his old, pockmarked face, his gigantic nose. He had told me about a soul-wrenching job he had at the post office. I didn't understand anything he was saying back then, but I think I do now. It wasn't until a couple years later, when I was visiting home up here in Michigan, when I finally saw him again. He was telling me about his pal Mike the Trashman. Mike would tell people, "Hey, we're offering a 10% discount for our wonderful customers if they pay in cash instead of online." Then he would pocket the money and tell the garbage company that they canceled their account. Henry roared with laughter. I loved Henry. Back then, you couldn't have paid me to go to college. After 5 years of high school, I had to repeat 10th grade because I missed so many days. I was burned out. High school felt like obedience training for humans to me. And to tell you the truth, I hadn't been present for much of my senior year either, on account of my internship. In August, before school started, my school counselor asked me if I wanted to consider less conventional options for my senior year. Obviously, I did. I found out later that my mom asked her to do that. She was worried I was going to check out entirely if I had to sit in that building for another year, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Luckily for me, there was a guy from my church, Andy Knapp, who worked for Coca-Cola as a graphic designer. I told my school counselor that this was an incredible opportunity, and I didn't care that he lived over an hour from school. I was willing to make the drive. She agreed that a graphic design internship was an excellent idea. I created a fake email address, andy.kdesign@gmail.com, made all the necessary arrangements with my counselor, and Mr. Knapp was none the wiser. I used all the time I was supposed to be in school to think about all the things that were on my mind. School doesn't really leave you with any time or energy for thinking about anything important. When I finally graduated, I left. I lied to my parents about where I was going. Nashville, I told them. That's where I would get a job and an apartment. I didn't want them to worry, which they would if they knew my plans, or lack thereof. After I left home, I actually did drive down to Nashville, but I didn't stay there for long. For well over a year, I wandered around and slept in the back of my car before I got any apartment. And don't get the wrong idea, it wasn't some journey of finding myself, where mom and dad paid all my bills as I embarked upon my career as a poet or something. My parents had enough trouble with their own bills, and I wanted to be completely on my own anyway. After buying a sleeping bag and a Planet Fitness membership so I could shower, I packed everything I owned in my blue Nissan Sentra that was older than I was, and pulled out of my driveway in November 2014 on a gray, windswept morning. I heaved a contented sigh. I was finally free. 2. I've had a lot of bad jobs since I left home. And it's not like I've ever been a crab fisherman, and there's never been a suicide net around the place I worked, but the service industry crushes your soul in special ways. By virtue of moving around all the time, I've had 8 or 9 unskilled, low-paying, short-term jobs over the last few years, and I began to notice patterns. They weren't all young people, for one, not by a long shot. There were high schoolers, yes, but also 20 and 30-somethings, middle-aged people, and folks well past retirement age. It's also never 9 to 5. There's prep time and recovery time, and a lot of people had multiple jobs. Your boss is always texting you outside of work, and you're expected to treat a $10 an hour job putting pizzas on a conveyor belt like it's the most important part of your life. There's also the can-I-speak-to-the-manager moms, who exercise their authoritarian impulses and terrorize the employees of Panera Breads across the nation. The purpose of their lives seems to be searching for anything that vaguely upsets them and screaming at you about it. Your uniform, which you probably had the privilege of paying for some reason means customers are allowed to say things to you that in every other conceivable circumstance would be socially unacceptable. Your uniform, by the way, is almost certainly a polyester polo, that is designed to be as unappealing as a shirt can scientifically be. Most of the other people there eat like shit, but you only have enough time and make enough money to basically live off the dollar menu. It's like the purge, but no one notices because it's gradual and includes McNuggets. In working all those menial jobs, I also noticed something I call the ubiquity of weed. At least a third, maybe half of all the workers in those places are high. And how could you possibly blame us? We're forced to serve tyrannical middle-class suburbanites who would drive anyone to anxiety and depression, at least, and pent-up homicidal rage at most, so you need something to keep your sanity. I think the previous generation of workers had happy hour, we have weed. These sorts of jobs seem to be the only kind of unskilled labor on offer after factories move to places where you can still hire kids and behead your employees without recompense. It feels like there's a domestic competition to see who can create the most demoralizing, least dignified work of all time, and still demand that we be grateful for the opportunity to have it, while keeping a fraction of the wealth that we actually generate in our position. Half your money goes to rent, which goes to some other guy who's ripping off his workers in the same way. I actually remember a high school assembly where my principal told us that the purpose of our education was to prepare us for our future jobs. I'm a stickler for the dress code because your boss will be someday too. I'm trying to prepare you to enter the workforce. He was definitely onto something. You're supposed to work hard on mindless tasks, exist under panopticon surveillance, obey personality-annihilating dress codes, be passive and show deference to those above you, no matter what they're saying or doing. You were supposed to internalize an ethic of obedience, which, as he rightly observed, prepared us for our lives in the job market. Maybe you're a waitress, or a car wash attendant, a cashier, a pizza delivery driver. I don't know. What I do know is that all your coworkers are high, and all the money they're making goes to someone else. I'd only encountered fragments of this grim reality when I was driving back through Tennessee. It was snowing. I had returned after a few weeks of hanging out in Colorado, primarily in a beautiful place called Manitou Springs. I could only drive 20 or 30 miles an hour in this weather, but the streets were abandoned. It was almost midnight and the blizzard had kept all the southern drivers home. It was uncharacteristically cold for Tennessee. I wanted to head farther south, maybe to Arkansas. The snow silently whirled down to the earth. It was falling heavier and heavier. The broad, five-lane, newly paved road was empty. Streetlights made it easy to see despite the falling snow. I felt content, perfectly content. It was quiet, and I loved solitude and driving, and the weather reminded me of Michigan. I was gliding effortlessly forward, silently through the snow and streetlights. I held the half-burned pipe in my lap and reached for my lighter. Red and blue lights lit up behind me. Are you kidding me? I threw the pipe under my seat and swore. The smell would be unmistakably strong when the cop walked up. I was fucked. This was the South. I was going to jail tonight. There was no way around it. I didn't have any car insurance either, so my car would be impounded. I'd have to get another job and walk there until I had the money to get it out. Where would I stay, though? I wasn't exactly sure about the consequences of any of this, but at least I was in Tennessee and not in Michigan. I can figure this out without any of it getting back to my parents. They wouldn't find out, right? How would they? At least there was that. I was trying to find a place to pull over, but the road had changed and there wasn't a shoulder. I was on some oddly winding road. The cop's lights had been on for close to 30 seconds now and I still hadn't come to a stop. He was right on my bumper. I saw a Wendy's ahead, but it sat beyond a slanting intersection, and I couldn't see the entrance through the snow and darkness. I nervously slowed to 10 miles an hour and frantically looked for a place I could stop. Impatient, the officer got on the squad car's PA system. "Turn your lights on," he yelled, irritated. I looked down at the switch. All my car's lights were off. I swiftly flipped them on. The cop slammed on his gas pedal and passed me on the left. I sheepishly waved as he sped away, and I waited breathlessly until he was out of sight. My heart was pounding, but my elation was pure. I was the luckiest man alive. 3. When I woke up on the couch, my mouth was dry, my head was throbbing, it was unbearably hot. I looked at my phone. 3:10 a.m. The TV was still on, and the flickering light felt like it was physically jabbing me in the eye socket. I'd been in Siloam Springs, Arkansas for over a month visiting a girlfriend. I met Juliana in Colorado, but she had begun attending John Brown University there in Siloam. That night we were couch surfing in a friend's apartment. A cartoonish infomercial voice blared from the TV. "Reverend Peter Popoff wants you to know that God can reverse every negative verdict in your life. You don't have to live a life sentence of lack and desperation. You can be free to enjoy all of God's richest blessings." A yacht and a Mercedes flew across the screen. "That's why he wants to send you a free packet of Miracle Spring Water, your point of contact for the miracle you need, now in a larger size." I was assailed with testimonials of church attendees and preaching, Jump cuts with garish gold letters flitting across the TV screen above a 1-800 number. A woman from the crowd appeared with a mic in front of her face. The banks told me I could not get another loan. We were so desperate. I prayed. I believed. I followed every instruction, and on May 26th, we closed on our dream home. The voiceover cut back in. Stop settling on less and reach for God's best. God is a God of more, and now there's miracle spring water in a new, larger packet. The screen flashed to another testimonial. You sent me the water and I used it. You told me I was going to get a check for $7,000. Sure enough, I got a check in the mail. It was exactly $7,000. Peter was back on screen. I will send you the miracle spring water. I'll send you the instructions. I'll tell you how to use it to see total victory in every area of your life, said Peter Popoff, the prosperity preacher who peddled placebo water to the poor. The word of God says, bring the tithe into the storehouse, and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven, and pour out so much blessing that there will not be enough room to store it. Amen. Even more have had huge sums of miracle money transferred into their accounts, supernaturally, the voiceover declared. You say, is that going to happen to me? Peter asked. Yes, the Bible teaches us in John 14:14, you may ask me for anything in my name, and I will do it. James chapter 4, verse 2. You do not have because you do not ask God. Claim it. Speak life. More gold letters flashed across the screen. Release God's miracle power, the voiceover blared. Act now. Call the number on your screen today and get your free packet of miracle spring water. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future. Peter was sitting with an open Bible in front of him. He looked up at the camera. Isn't it amazing to see what God is doing? The TV cut to a commercial for Nutrisystem and I closed my eyes. How does he make money sending free water in the mail? I hadn't realized Juliana was awake. I turned my aching head to the recliner next to me. She looked nonplussed, her eyes still turned towards the screen. Peter's grift appeared to be sending a free packet of miracle water to whoever was desperate enough to ask for it, and then he advised them that the wisest thing they could do financially was give him money. Give God money. He's just trying to get a mailing list, I think. And then they get 500 letters about planting seed money. Juliana looked on silently. So what do they do when nothing happens? She asked. I'm guessing they just have to collect their reward after death. My head was still aching. I had a text from Henry. We'd been talking about work earlier that night, a subject I increasingly felt I could only talk about with him. I delivered pizzas and saved my money for a few weeks in Tennessee, which I kept coming back to for some reason. Like every other place I worked, weed was everywhere all the time. Pizza delivery wasn't all that bad, at least compared to Panera or Burger King or waiting tables. The problem was my car kept breaking down. It did that all the time anyway, but having the thing running all day made car problems a near daily occurrence. They never really stopped, not for me or anyone I worked with, pizza place or otherwise. Anyone who can't buy their way out of problems is trapped in multiple, eternally recurring storylines, car troubles being one of them. You're driven mad by the tedious, cyclic repetition of problems with your car. It's like a reverse lottery. You take your car in and find out how much money is going to be drained from your bank account. Life wasn't moving forward and evolving, changing into something new or better. It was a barrage of tiresome stories that repeated over and over again. I eventually had to quit because my car kept breaking down, which had become even more of a madness-inducing loop than it already was. 4. I stood facing the massive logo, Mr. Car Wash. I'd been working at a car wash for a few months when we were acquired by a national chain that was buying up smaller companies left and right. We were one of them. Lucky us. There was an email printed and posted on the bulletin board from the ex-owner's idiot son, Greg, addressed to all of us, littered with errors as usual. His dad had sold the company to Mr. and flew to Bora Bora, but his son was kept on as a regional manager, a demotion from his previous position of vice president. Before the acquisition, Greg primarily demonstrated his level of productivity by striding around at 1,000 miles an hour, despite not having anything to do or anywhere to be. Now that his job wasn't just being the owner's son, he immediately hired an assistant to do the bulk of the work he was suddenly expected to do. Sam, a middle manager, was promoted to be in charge of our little store. He tried to reassure us that everything would be business as usual, that sort of thing. No one believed him, but the worst part of the meeting was his description of becoming a higher-ranked employee at a car wash. "Look, guys, I know what it's like to work from the bottom and get all the way to the top. You can do it too." It was depressing as hell. Before the acquisition, Sam had this long beard that took him years to grow. He obviously loved it, and everyone who came identified him by it. It was a part of him. It didn't match the new company's appearance guidelines, though, and he had to shave it if he wanted to keep his job. He had just taken out a big loan a month or so before the acquisition and didn't have much of a choice. Soon after, the new owners cut our pay by $2 an hour and doubled our responsibilities. A few people quit after that since the only reason they stayed were those couple of dollars that made the job stand out a little. Most egregiously, we now had to wear fanny packs. I have decided that when I am dictator of America, fanny packs will be illegal and punishable by death. After I heard about the order for Sam to shave his beard, I asked him in frustration, "What if the government said, hey, here's a list of approved types of facial hair? Wouldn't that seem, I don't know, insane? Too much control over our personal lives?" "That's not the same thing," Sam replied. "How is it different?" He looked annoyed. "Hey, where is your supply belt?" "My fanny pack?" "It's not a fanny pack. It is literally a fanny pack." Sam sighed. "I know." "Why do we have to wear this stupid fucking thing?" Sam sighed again. "Look, you need to find it in you to be positive about Mister. Your attitude can't just be, well, Mister sucks, everything sucks. That's not helpful." All this reminded me of something Henry said when he'd been drinking too much and ranting about work. A lot of workers suffer from the delusion that they might be owners themselves someday, but even the ones who are not don't want to admit the reality of their situation either. No one wants to let their mind go there. Deep down, they know they're getting ripped off. They hate their boss, or at least their boss's boss. They hate their jobs. But what else are you supposed to do? It's all inevitable, or so it feels. So why make yourself unhappy by recognizing all this when you can't do anything to change it? Most people, including Sam, seem to think that it only further immiserates yourself to acknowledge any of it. Our grievances against Mr. ranged from the trivial to the not-so-trivial, like the major pay cut and the increase in hours that was simultaneous with a crackdown on overtime. Fucking Greg installed a camera right outside the bathroom since he suspected theft. It turned out that a 20-something new mother was stealing toilet paper. She was fired the next day. A few weeks later, I accidentally said the word union within earshot of Greg, and oddly enough, I was fired the next week for unrelated offenses, including being too negative about our fanny packs. Why does everyone put up with the absurd level of control every company wants over you? Why does anyone put up with any of this? The drudgery of most people's jobs is bad enough. Add to that how pointless the work feels, how arbitrary the rules are, and the indignities, minor and not so minor. You have to live with the chronic uncertainty and insecurity, and the neuroses that follow knowing you're always one mistake away from material ruin, whether it's getting sick or injured, or getting annoyed with your boss. Your only respite, besides drugs, are the unpaid, terse, and infrequent breaks, which your boss seems to resent you for taking. The gap between the ones who give the orders and the ones who take them only seems to increase, and how out of touch they are along with it. Most of the real bosses, the owners, are smart enough to stay out of sight and out of mind. It's easier for them when there's no obvious monarch who's clearly and directly responsible. They delegate a lot of their dirty work to their underlings, pitting everyone below them against each other, so they never look up. You spend the majority of your time doing something you'd rather not do, all for the purpose of making money that you'll never see, for someone who doesn't have your best interests at heart. Questioning why it's inherently virtuous to work hard in such a job is taboo, and so is acknowledging the fact that the owners are not your friends, that what's good for you is bad for them, and what's good for them is bad for you, that they're the reason for your precarious existence. So you show up, people yell at you, you stop caring about anything there, get a 10-cent raise every other leap year, collect what's left of your money, pretend to be happy about your wage slavery, and on it goes. You do that for however long you can tolerate it before you want to blow your brains out, and then you quit and move on to the next temporary shitty job and repeat. It's another one of those cycles you're forever trapped in. I started doing that when I was 19. Now I'm 23. I decided I wanted to break that eternal cycle by going into about $500 million of debt to go to school, but that didn't last very long. Honestly, it wasn't that different. 5. I hadn't seen Henry in quite a while. He had aged a lot in the last couple years, and his greasy gray hair looked greasier than usual, but his eyes were bright. "So what are you doing now? You deliver food with a fucking app?" I nodded. "There's no dress code, and I can at least listen to podcasts and stuff." "Why'd you quit that other place? They wouldn't give you a raise?" "Yep," I replied. "Fuck 'em," Henry shouted, a little loudly. Henry would always be in my corner. After a brief silence, he said, "Why'd you leave here in the first place?" I didn't hesitate. "Because I wanted freedom." He grinned. "Do you feel free?"